I appreciated Keith's remarks last week about Rohr's book not being linear, being circular or perhaps Semitic rather than Greek. That's very obvious when you're a presenter trying to look at the chapters, and they say things like getting the who right. They don't say something neat like grace or redemption or something you can easily put an idea to. Well, I would suggest that the Bible also is not linear. I was thinking about that when Rohr suggests that we look at the whole Bible and connect the dots. Well, I wonder, how many of you have actually read the whole Bible? Well, I see 5, 6, 7, 8 hands. Did you read it sort of in order?
No.
No. Do you think it's easy to connect the dots? I sort of wonder what he meant by that. Of course, right now, when connect the dots seems to mean finding underwear bombers before they board airplanes, as though there's something particular we need to find out. I don't think that's what he meant. In fact, just as I was sitting here, I thought connecting the dots could be sort of like looking up at the night sky and trying to make patterns among the constellations. But there are probably different ways to connect the dots. And that's fine. So why do we get so uptight about getting the right answer? Because the Bible really does not give us a definitive God's eye panorama of human history and the human condition from some great distance up there with everything laid out in perfect order. It's an anthology of materials, Semitic or circular, as Keith said. I think John brought up the term poetic last week. I can't remember whether it was in connection with the Bible or the liturgy or what. But unless we understand that a lot of the Bible is meant to inspire and motivate as much as to inform, then we're going to miss the point. So it's messy. There are all sorts of very human deeds and emotions in the Bible, sometimes attributed to God. There are parts that are vengeful, tender, anguished, boastful, triumphant, thoughtful, awestruck, questioning. Everything human is there, and that's the way it's meant to be. Now, the title of Rohr's book, Things Hidden, Things Hidden, is taken, as you will see in the epigraph on the page before the table of contents, is taken from Psalm 78. I will speak to you in parables and reveal to you things hidden since the foundation of the world. Things hidden. That sounds like a mystery, doesn't it? And here I'd like to refer back to one of the quotes Keith made last week, a quote from Rohr. Mystery is not something unknowable, but something infinitely knowable. I think that's really important as we approach the whole book. So I think we will be looking at passages in the Bible in the same way that we look at parables. Not as sources for historical, scientific, or doctrinal facts. And of course, the subtitle is Scripture as Spirituality. I'm actually very relieved about that. I don't want to do Scripture as theology. Again, we're not looking for theological teaching in the sense of doctrine, but more for life lessons. I'll give that to you. Where did you learn about God and about Jesus? Bible stories? Catechism? Sermons? All of the above. Anything else? What do you think was predominant in your particular? How persistent it was? I heard someone say catechism. Catholic schools. And what was the approach, would you say? Doctrinal.
Redemption theology.
Redemption theology. So that was the emphasis.
The fall and the redemption.
Fall and redemption. So there are particular emphases. Now I ask this because I didn't grow up with all that. As you may know, I'm a convert. I grew up in an agnostic home. So I had something I think of as an advantage of reading the Bible with a beginner's mind, not with the overlays of philosophical or theological or catechetical interpretations. In this chapter, Rohr talks about reading the Bible with poverty of spirit. I kind of thought maybe that's somewhat the same way. Just trying to read it without all that stuff in the background. In particular, without the sort of sense of, oh, know-it-all, I know it, kind of attitude. In other words, with humility about our interpretations, which are human, partial, and often culture-bound and tradition-bound. Now, I suppose I ought to make a caveat here. I don't want to denigrate the tradition or the intellectual quest because it's part of our human nature to seek understanding. It's part of our human culture, particularly our Western culture perhaps, to try to make sense of everything, to organize our data into a coherent system, to look for a theory of everything, whether it's in science or in theology, so we get our great summas and other things. And I would say the sharing of this quest is exciting, particularly when we can do it in forms that have a bit more give and take. The problem comes when we decide that we have the truth and we're going to tell everybody else what it is. And this happens less, actually, with the people who do the theologizing than with the people who follow them. I think, you know, the people who follow an Augustine or an Aquinas kind of idolize their teachers, and they're no longer on the quest, are they? Yeah, they're trying to pass on what their teachers told them. And in the process, they tend to simplify it. They tend to rigidify it. And pretty soon, it kind of ends up as a catechism, isn't it? And in that sense, they have lost an inner authority. They're appealing to an outer authority of their teacher. And that's one of the themes that Rohr will talk about. We need to find our own inner authority. In other words, to listen, certainly to listen to what others have said, because that sharing is exciting. But to find our own center. I got off on a sidetrack when I was preparing for this. I looked up catechism in the dictionary and discovered that that's really a Reformation genre of literature. Luther wrote a couple of very important catechisms, and of course once Luther did, the Catholics had to too. And you can tell what happened. They got polemical. Because Luther was writing against the Catholic views and the Catholics were writing against the Lutheran views. And what does that do to our theological quest? I think it's good that we've passed that 500-year rummage sale that Tickle and others have said, you know, we've got 500 years past the Reformation and it's time to have our rummage sale and decide what is still good and what isn't. So, on to chapter 2, getting the who right. It's basically about the beginning chapters of Genesis, and it provides a way to think about some very basic questions. Where do we come from? Why is the world the way it is? These are the kinds of questions children ask, right? I mean, I think those of us who are parents, you know, remember kids asking questions like that. Well, it's a very basic human question. We all ask that. Even though as we grow up, we kind of think it's childish. It's not. It's important. So just who are we, individually and collectively? I will speak to you in parables, and revealed to you things hidden since the foundation of the world. The psalm goes on to say, things that we have heard and known, that our ancestors have told us, we will not hide from our children, but tell to the coming generation the glorious deeds of Yahweh and his might. All those parables, all those things hidden, are, among others, the glorious deeds of Yahweh. We're supposed to think about everything that the Bible has told us, even if it's presented as history or anything else, as a parable. Something we mull over and find the meanings in and discuss. Now, that very word parable tells us that there's got to be more than one way to connect the dots. The word suggests that a variety of interpretations are possible. The Hebrew word is mashal. It means a comparison. You recognize that from, you know, the kingdom of heaven is like this or is like that. It can also mean a riddle or a figurative story. The Greek word is parabole. It's the same word as parabola. You know what a parabola is. It goes like this. It's not a beeline. It tells you what the truth is. You know, it's a journey that gets you somewhere. And the journey is as important as the end line, in a sense. So, Rohr is going to try to help us connect the dots, and he's going to give us a lot of ideas. This chapter is full of all sorts of ideas, and I think that's where the excitement is. Know the different ideas. Don't expect it to be fully organized or all laid out, but it is a way to further discussion, to sharing insights, and a way to encourage our own ownership of the biblical material, to find our own inner authority. Of course, in conjunction with listening to other people and you know, the wisdom of the ages, which is the outer authority. It seems to me that the major theme of this chapter is original blessing. That was a headline in one of the early sections. Now, here I have to say, he's not reading this with a beginner's mind. Original blessing is obviously a response to something in the tradition. I'm sure you all know what that is. Original sin. Now, original sin is not a biblical phrase. It's not a concept from the Jewish tradition. You know, that kind of surprises us. We think it was there from the beginning, right? They didn't interpret it that way. There are places where the Old Testament tradition says things that we've latched on to. In guilt was I born. In sin did my mother conceive me. In the Psalms. But then the Psalms also say, I give you thanks that I am wonderfully, fearfully made. Or you have made humankind little less than the angels. So you have both. And I don't know why we emphasize one, but that's what happened in our own cultural trajectory. Basically, original sin is based on some of the things Paul said, particularly in his letter to the Romans. In Adam, all sinned. And therefore, we needed a second Adam, namely Christ. Now, think what Paul was doing. He was writing a letter to a Christian community in Rome, which he had never visited, and which had strong Jewish roots, and which was very concerned with the issue of the relationship between the Jews and the Gentiles, and why whether the Jewish covenant was still good or not. And so he's trying to explain, you know, why Christ had to come. So he draws this thing about an Adam all sinned, and so we needed a second Adam. He's not nearly as pessimistic about humanity as our original sin tradition. So it is legitimate at least to look at both various interpretations of the Genesis story besides the one that we've kind of latched onto, and also what it was Paul was seeking to accomplish and what he thought that was. So with all that, I want to hear what your interpretations are of the story of Adam and Eve and the serpent. What was their sin, first of all? Okay. Disobedience. Is that a unanimous agreement? Unanimous? That's what the Catholic Catechism said. I looked up, I found a Baltimore Catechism that I picked up for 50 cents, and it very clearly states it was disobedience. Does anybody have any other?
The desire to be in control.
The desire to be in control.
The desire to grow up and experience things like an adult.
The desire to grow up.
The thing that amazes me about original sin is that when one is a child, one was told that this was just a story.
Okay, that's an important point.
A story, and everything was based around this damn original sin. So you're born with a sin, and you haven't done anything yet. It's horrible to be born that way.
Okay. Christiane.
Thomas Keating understood for me for the first time. He said that the Garden of Eden is a metaphor for being born innocent and pure. And when the ego is born, we leave the Garden of Eden. But I also think, why do we call it sin? I think it's part of our making. God created us to have an ego and to go on a spiritual journey and come back eventually, if we choose so or are aware of it, to our original birth purity, that with wisdom. The wisdom is impossible without the ego. So the original sin was meant to happen. So why call it even a sin?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Lee.
Full disclosure, I was raised and still am a Presbyterian. And so this whole concept of original sin never made any sense at all to me. But I just wanted to say I really appreciated Rohr's phrase, original shame and original blessing. Mm-hmm. That really said something.
Anna.
I like the way Rohr, I think it's, we talked about it, where we became disconnected. And that it was the showing of how we can get alienated and disconnected. And so the journey is to get back, to always to come back and to be connected again.
So we've heard about the role of the ego and having to do that journey. We've heard about original shame being a real part of the human dilemma. And then we had Anna, so I see a lot of other hands too. Keith.
I don't know where I heard this, but a long time ago, somebody was talking about when we look at human nature and we see the shadow side, the darkness. And this man, whoever, well, I don't even remember, was saying, that's what they meant by original sin. How to explain this shadow side of man and his violence and his cruelty and his selfishness. That's not God's image. That's always stuck with me.
Yeah, the shadow side that is not God's image. We're going to come back to that one thing.
I was a little confused. He says our family of origin is divine, right? And then on the next page he says we cannot ever get worthy, but we can get reconnected. How? I don't understand that.
Well, just off the top of the hat, the top of my head, I'm wondering whether the idea of worthiness is in part, you know, one of the things in our Western Catholic background is the theology of Saint Anselm, who talked about why God became human, and it had to do with our inability, once we sinned, to be worthy enough, and so you had to find a sacrifice that was worthy enough to make up for the sin against this all-worthy God. So I wonder if it's part of that worthy, maybe there are times when I think he's fighting that thing, and also the whole Reformation thing about, can you fix it yourself? Yeah. Or do you need God's grace? That was a huge Reformation fight. And those, Rohr's talking about, yeah, you can't. The flip side of are we worthy or not is really God's grace is everywhere. I mean, in a sense, the worthy language, I'm not sure it helps at that point. I mean, I think we feel a sense of unworthiness the same way we feel a sense of shame. Martha.
I always thought, I think and one way of looking at original sin is that we all are born into families that are not perfect. Mm-hmm. And so that we, and our parents were born into families that were perfect. It goes way back. And so somehow we carry those imperfections from generations past that we really have no control over.
Yeah.
And so and that to me is is kind of, I don't know.
Yeah.
Another way of looking at it.
Yeah. There's a way in which if you look at us as being not just sort of solitary individuals, but as part of a community, having to respond to what is around us, you know, we're going to make mistakes. I mean, and any parent knows that. I mean, this beautiful child comes into the world, and it's innocent and pure and all that, but this child is going to be raised, and you know, the two-year-old not going to understand why the other two-year-old wants his toy. They're going to get into a fight. We aren't solitary. We live in communities, and we therefore end up with struggles. So, I mean, that's part of original sin, too. Just that those complications. Yes?
In the Bible, there seems to be so much envy and jealousy. It starts very young. Mm-hmm. And if we are created in the image of God. It almost seems innate, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, is our jealousy and our envy innate? Is there something kind of self-centered about the child that comes into the world? Maybe it's inevitable. I mean, that poor kid is dependent on everybody else for him even to live. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In our family, it's so emphasized that we learn the answers to the catechism questions, and I don't ever remember hearing that I was made in God's image, or that I was good from the get-go, you know, that I was God's child. I didn't hear that, and I think that was left out of the whole equation at that time. And that was that.
Yeah, was that, do other people feel that way too? That, that was a sort of rush to get your baby to baptism because it was already an original sin. And doesn't that kind of run counter to the experience of holding a newborn in your arms? I sometimes wonder if we'd have the same theology if we had parents making it up.
I'm the youngest of five children, and so I can't conceive of why everyone doesn't think I'm wonderful. So I've never been real happy about this whole concept of original sin. And now that I'm 66, I don't like it at all. I don't want to think that somebody passed on to me something that's not okay, that I'm being judged or that I'm stuck somehow in this thing. When I encounter in ministry, when I encounter people who are caught in that, I think, especially in hospital ministry sometimes, I'll say, why don't you, can I help you get free of this? Why did, who made you feel this way? And there's a tremendous reconciliation takes place. Because in the name of Christianity and the Bible, I think we condemn people to horrible ideas about who they are.
The who is not right. let's get a new hit.
I don't know. I hear a lot of talk about, you know, the abusive family, where we are driven to family, and that definitely influences, did influence me. But as I get older and I mature, I realize that I have to own some of that. And I have to face it and change. If I need to change, to get rid of that shame, I can. And I can because God loves me for mm-hmm. no other reason that I am.
Yeah.
Okay? So all this talk about catechism and what was and all, that's all fine, but for me, it's all history.
Mm-hmm.
It's all history.
Mm-hmm.
What is now is where I am in my life, what I'm facing, and what I'm changing, and mm-hmm. how that change enables me to be closer to the Lord.
Mm-hmm. John.
All this keeps reminding me, this whole idea of earning heaven and gaining merit and so on and so forth. There was a guy named Pelagius,
mm-hmm.
and there's an heresy named after him, Pelagianism. And basically what he said is we can work and sweat and go to the gym, spiritual gym, and exercise and all this stuff, and somehow make ourselves worthy of faith,
yeah.
and God gives it to us.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, semi-Pelagianism came along, and that says we hold ourselves ready. We sit in our rooms and we're ready to go.
Mm-hmm.
No. It is gift. Faith is gift. Grace is gift. And it is we are gifted with it from birth.
Mm-hmm.
God is present with us, within us. If we listen to Michael Barwood, God is within each of us, within the spaces between the particles of our very atoms.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that is, I think, one of the things we need to lay hold of is this whole idea of it is all gift.
Mm-hmm. And the gift is offered to everybody? that became a big fight. Augustine thought we've been, you know, we're sort of waiting, and maybe God doesn't give it to everybody. We need it. and of course, this eventually developed into a theory of double predestination. Some people were predestined to have the gift and others not. So we've had a lot of fights over that too. But, you know, the primary thing, it seems to me, is yes, this is gift. That's part of the original blessing. I think I'm on even good theological grounds to say that, but there certainly have been fights about that one. Jude.
I want to add a little levity to it to show you how rare we were in the 40s. I was a seminarian in Cincinnati, Ohio. We had a young priest, and he gave us a religion quiz. He said, if you miss number 3, you're flunked. True or false? Adam and Eve committed the sin of gluttony when they ate of the fruit. That's a question. We were very aware way back. Because, you know, that just showed the ridiculousness of it.
Well, I looked up a lot of views of original sin, and one of the ones I found was the Egyptian desert fathers who thought that the sin was gluttony. Mm-hmm. They were big into fasting
mm-hmm.
and seeing how little they could subsist on.
Mm-hmm.
So they thought it was wanting food.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we had always grown up that it was wanting sex. That was what this is. And I think what these gentlemen are saying, and what you're saying, that's why we're here, to be adults, and to try to get that stuff out of our heads so that we can mature and grow up and be beyond second grade. I am glad that I'm here.
Well, you know, I ran into that one going back into the ancient times, too. The idea that sex was the original sin was actually espoused by mostly heretics, the ones who thought that sex and marriage were bad altogether. The more general opinion of people like Ambrose and Jerome was that we were meant to be sexless, we were meant to be virgins, that was a state in paradise. But then when Adam sinned and death was the penalty, then God created sex as a remedy for it. So the human race would continue. And Augustine actually was more enlightened. He thought that there was a kind of pure sex because we were told to go forth and multiply, right? Before the fall, but of course we were always in perfect control of our desires and never out of control. Until we fell, and then it was all kind of spoiled by these kind of possessive instincts. So
And then sex was hidden and our bodies were bad, and that's what happened with all this freak stuff. I mean, it's just, it had to come out someplace.
Forgive me for recalling this anecdote from childhood, that the gang I went around with used to joke, "What did Adam and Eve wear?" Yeah. Well, Eve wore a fig leaf and Adam wore a hole in it.
Moore talked about God giving us the Adam and Eve the choice in the Garden of Eden. From any tree. That was such an incredible concept for me, that God can look at the abundance, the choice, and the freedom. And he says on page 31, God's main problem is how to give away God. And the choice that he gives us, that was such a revelation. Not that, oh my gosh, they made a wrong choice. Look at how many choices they had.
Yeah. The abundant God. How do you see the tree of the knowledge of good and evil? That is a mysterious thing. I was a bit amused and a bit put off when Roy at one point suggested it was more or less the same as moral theology.
Oh, yeah.
That was kind of funny, but he was talking about the sort of know-it-all. We know what's sinful and what isn't. Yeah. We know what's good and what's bad, and we will listen to your confessions accordingly or something like that. He goes on and says other things about it. Why the tree of the knowledge of good and evil? What does it mean?
Bipolar thinking.
Bipolar thinking.
Well, you know, without free choice, we'd just be another animal running around in the forest.
So you see it as necessary to human...
It's humanity. It's what makes us human and different.
I think there's a lot of people who feel that was part of what we had to do to grow up.
And it wasn't necessarily the wrong choice. It wasn't like he describes it as a dead end. It was, you know, they came across what they hit was universal law, a consequence, you know, cause and effect. And what they did with that.
Yeah. I thought a hand up in the rear. Was that Nancy?
When I was young and in Sunday school, the church, we only learned about that they ate from the tree of knowledge, but the good and evil was left off. And so that was always a puzzle. Why was it so bad to have knowledge?
Yeah. Did God want us to remain stupid? That might be convenient for the teachers. Or the church leaders, I don't know. Don.
One way that I see this is that, you know, we have that statement, the devil is in the details. Well, I think we could say God is in the details also, both of them. And that this issue here is the issue of this wonderful, blessed child, all potentiality, no actuality yet, has to incarnate. And incarnation always means a choice. So in a way, in our minds, we can hold both hands. But when we make a choice, we are committing ourselves to something that is at some time good and sometime evil. I mean, Jung talks a lot about it, not necessarily this language, but that all we can hope is that the good out. I'm trying to evil by a little bit, you know. Not that we get to a place of being only one and never the other. So this is, I think, the introduction of the notion of incarnation in Scripture. It's not possible to stay at a place of of all blessedness, yeah, that once we start to concretize,
mm-hmm,
we're going to have to give up something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like the health book.
Yeah. It's also nice when it's in theory and then when you get onto it. Well, I want to go back a minute since I see we're approaching 11 o'clock. Back to the section on original blessing, which highlights the goodness of creation and of ourselves. Something he calls our objective unity with God, by which I take it he means something opposite to our subjective sense of separation. That is to say, we are united with God even if we don't feel it. And especially we are the image and likeness of God. And I brought up... You got that, okay. You know, we in the West particularly developed this notion of original sin, but I wanted to contrast it with another theology, which is about the image of God in us. This, of course, is the Eastern theology of the icon. Icon means image. And let me see, where are my notes on that? This particular icon, incidentally, is from the monastery at the foot of Mount Sinai. It was recovered back in the 60s when they took off layers of paint that was on top of it, and realized that this probably dates to before the Muslims overtook Sinai in 640. So this is probably 6th century icon. And this seems like a very perfect way to talk about the image of God in human form. The theology of the icon just explores this. Of course, Christ is the perfect image of God. Christ is the perfect image, that's what it says in Colossians 1. Christ is the perfect image of God. And that is the goal to which we also aspire. There's a whole part of Orthodox theology that says God became human so that humans could become God. And it's, you know, this sort of contemplative prayer, that's again another theme of Rohr's and of the emerging church, that there's a contemplative aspect that we need to recover. So I brought in a couple of quotes from the scriptures that I think this highlights. This is from 1 John 3:2, first letter of John. We are God's children now. What we shall later be has not yet come to light. Maybe I should change the emphasis. We are God's children now, but what we shall later be has not yet come to light. We know that when it comes to light, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. And perhaps a more familiar quote from 1 Corinthians 13. Now we see indistinctly as in a mirror. Then we shall see face to face. My knowledge is imperfect now. Then I shall know even as I am known. This is your foretaste of realizing that you are in the image of God. And let's see. I got 5 minutes. I'm going to show my other picture, which is a very different one. The only thing that bothers me about that is we know that God's image comes in both male and female form, right? So I brought in another image, which is not an icon. This is a more narrative image. It's of the Annunciation. It's a rather unusual Annunciation. And maybe we could talk about it a little later. But, of course, it is part of Catholic theology that, and Orthodox theology, that Mary is a perfect reflection of God in female form, in a sense. That is, you know, untainted in some of the same ways we are. Now, I don't want to get into how that developed or anything like that. Rohr does talk a little bit about the Annunciation in today's chapter, and actually maybe why don't we talk about this picture or anything else you want to talk about after the break, because That is by Henry Tanner.
Tanner,
T-A-N-N-E-R. Just to let you know, he lived, I think, well, this is from 1907 or I can't, don't remember exactly, early 20th century. He was African American, which I think has some bearing on why he did it this way. But I think there's a lot that we could talk about that too. Why he depicted the angel that way, for example. Okay, well, let's take our break now.
And as you walk back, I think you'll notice there's an easel with, is that where it is? Nearby, yes. It's it's on that table. It's the obituary for Sister Marilyn Rudy. It was published in the Tidings. So you might enjoy looking at that.
She was a member of our community while she lived up here, and then she moved down to L.A. So.
Thank you.